I think there's this really hard balancing act, the power of giving your body the chance. And that's one of the magical things about these 100s, is not to go down these judgment spirals, to have a constant curiosity about what you might be capable of. Also, don't be afraid to put yourself out there. A DNF in the long term, also fine. Sometimes that those are the price to pay for breakthroughs. If you ever struggle with that mindset part of like, oh, does this mean I'm a failure? It's like, no, actually, it means the opposite. You are validating your experience as a fully realized trail runner.
We want to thank again our wonderful partners that make this podcast special, especially Exoskin. They've been around for a long time with us, Don.
And there's a good reason. Have you ever had someone ask you, how do you run that far? And you know what? Part of the big secret is Exoskin and putting on the gear that allows you to perform things humans normally don't do.
They take away that variable of friction and wetness by pulling the wetness away from your foot, making the friction as low as possible so you don't have blisters and chafage.
So if your friends knew about Exoskin, they'd be running 100 miles, 50 miles, 25 miles as well.
Heck, you could do it. Go to exoskin.us. And if you enter the code TRN, you can get 15% off. They have a whole bunch of new toe sock colors, Don.
And that's amazing. Your toes will be happier. You'll look good, you'll feel good, and you'll run well.
Exoskin.us, or you can go to our deals page at trailrunnernation.com. Guys and gals, we need to tell you about Run the Alps. Now is the time to get over to Europe and take advantage of Run the Alps guided trips around the Alps, from Tour de Mont Blanc to Switzerland and also the Italian Dolomites.
And Europe is now open to vaccinated American travelers. And although summer is already booked with their trips, they do have openings later in the fall.
There's limited availability for a September trip to France and Switzerland, including a chance to race the 50th anniversary of the oldest trail race in the Alps called the Don de Midi. Is that related to you?
Scott, you said that perfectly. The Don de Midi. Hey, and my goodness, the Alps are so beautiful. If you have a chance to go and get in the middle of them and run them, you should. Don't let that window of opportunity pass you by.
Make sure that you go to runthealps.com to check out what their availability is. Or if you can't remember that, go to our deals page and click on the link.
Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Don Freeman.
And I'm Scott War, and this is another edition of Ask the Coaches, but we're going to do something a little bit differently. It was a short, 2 to 3 weeks ago that Western States 100 was run, and all three of our coaches were there, and it's the first time I've met all three of them face-to-face. I mean, I think I've met Chrissy, and I think I've met Ian. I don't know if I've met David face-to-face, but all of them were there. And we chatted and had a good time. All of them had were doing some coaching. Ian and Chrissy were there to pace. Ian ended up pacing. Chrissy did not. And we'll talk about that and hopefully some lessons learned there. But we thought, let's use this as a platform, not necessarily a Western States race report per se, but what can we learn as crew, pacers, coaches from race day? And to give you a little bit of a background with Western States, if you didn't know what the results were, this was a hot year, and only about 48% of the people that started the race finished the race. Some of the other notable...
I'm just going to point, I think it's actually 66%.
Thank you, Ian. That's why we have you do the math, is because I can't do the math. I thought I just did the math before, but we'll go with your number. A relatively low number, we should say, finished the race. The other thing that I thought was outstanding was three of the top 10 finishers were female. And this is the killer statistic. This is where it shows women just killed it at Western States this year. 11 of the top 25 were women. Did I get those right, Ian? Chrissy?
I don't know about the 25. I think it was like half of the top 30, though.
Yeah, half of the top 30 and four. It went all the way to 40, I think. It was like 20 out of 40 or 19 out of 40. That was awesome to watch.
War, did you look any of this stuff up, or are you just pulling it out of your hat? Because you haven't got anything right.
Hey, Don, I just have a question for you. Did you know Western States ran this year?
I followed it remotely. Some of us weren't able to get there.
Anyway, so this was a fun time. There was a lot of struggle out there. The other thing, and this I'm not sure of the statistic off the top of my head, but I think it was like 45% of all of the runners came in the last 2 hours of the race. So it was a hard day for a lot of people, and we want to talk about some of the lessons that we learned, or the coaches learned as they were there observing. And that's the premise of today's show. And hopefully the lessons that we learn, you guys can incorporate into your training and racing and become better runners.
I think David had something to say halfway through your dialogue there, Scott. David, what?
Oh, as always, completely irrelevant. But I think it was one of the slowest median finishing time ever for a year that wasn't the cutoff wasn't extended. So it was a tough year all around. And I think being there, I mean, for all of us that were there, was eye-opening in many ways, because I think it's easy for anyone to idealize ultras, and understanding what goes into a 29-hour Western States and really seeing it on the ground is so much different than perhaps some of the ideals that you might read about in an article I write or something like that.
Well, there's always something to learn from races, whether you're running them, crewing them, volunteering for them, or just driving by some runners who are going down the road on California Street, and you look to your left and you go, what are those people doing over there? There's something to take away. So let's just start off and kind of roundtable it, and some of your takeaways that one of the coaches has to help share with us so we can become better runners.
I can speak to that last stat. I ran out and back on the course. I left the track around 9:30 p.m., got back, slept for a couple hours, and then got out again around 9 a.m., and the number of people in the last 2 hours, it was like a stream of people just, can I make it? I'm going to make it. Just cheering people on. It was so cool to see both. And I would say in that first run the night before, it got tough keeping track of top 10 men and women, because there were so many women integrated in that. So it was a really fun couple, like back-to-back runs, mostly for the observation of how people were coming in.
I've got a question for the coaches, and all of our coaches have stood several times on podiums. As you watch the first group of 10 runners coming through, whether you were at the track or not, you can imagine, because you've been one of those runners. Who was running harder, the first group of 10 or the last group of 10? Who was running with more guts as they came through the finish around that track? Any comments, any thoughts?
So I'll jump in on that one. I think it's tempting to say that like one group is harder than the other. I think it's all pretty similar. And to give people an understanding of what I'm saying, at Western States now, they have drug testing of the top 10 men and the top 10 women after the race. So there's a drug testing tent where everyone has to go right after they finish. So they get a little bit of glory, and then they're just shuttled off to wait 5 hours to pee. It's quite a scene. But in that tent, I think there's a temptation to be, they make it look easy when they cross the line, their arms are up. That tent was carnage. Like I can't even emphasize enough how much it was, the people that were in there, for the most part, other than perhaps Tyler Green, who was fresh as a daisy, most of them had dug really deep, and it was hours later and they were still, clearly in a little bit of discomfort. And I think that experience was probably one of the magical things about ultras. It's like this shared journey, especially on a hot year at Western States, where you're stepping into the inferno. And however long you are in the inferno, it's really uncomfortable to be in the inferno. And so I'll say it's probably similar, especially on a hot year when like it's tough on everyone. And, I think for all of us coaches, getting windows into what the next week looks like for some of these athletes, whether at the front or the back, can let you know. I think it's independent of pace, and we're all digging as deep as we can on the day with the tools that we have.
Love it.
So David, what you're telling us is those top 10 finishers come in and before they enter the track, they're wiping the dirt off their face and doing their hair. They come through the finish line with their hands above their head, take the photo op because that's what's going to be in all of the magazines. And then they go into the tent and they just crash.
Yeah, it is. I think everyone needs to like take just a glance, not to be intrusive, not to get on privacy issues, but so, you know, an athlete will come in, do this interview that maybe you might see if you're watching a live stream or something. And Ian's experienced this personally in the last year or two, I think. And then you're immediately walked back with like a supervisor who is eventually going to watch you pee. But sometimes those pees take 4 hours. And in that time, you're just kind of commiserating with your fellow wounded. And sometimes when the pee comes out is... calling it Coca-Cola would be an understatement. You know, I think it gets back to just how difficult this race is. And I think a lot of the lessons we're going to talk about center on that difficulty and how that shapes training and race approach.
So the tent is there really to hide the finishers from the other people that might consider running ultra marathons. And so that's really the purpose of the tent. All right. I like it. So who's got the next lesson or the takeaway?
Actually, I just had one thing to add to that, which is I think it's a good example. I was on a podcast yesterday for Ultra Aspire with Kyle Pitieri. So he's been top 10 the last 5 years. He was sick this time. And he's also known for puking as soon as he finishes. Like he looks totally normal, sits down, he's talking to you, and then he goes 1 minute and then spends 30 minutes just projectile vomiting into a bucket, just out of nowhere, it seems, but it happens every time. So he was saying how this time, because he was comfortably in the top 10 and there's a bit of a gap between the guy ahead and the guy behind, he didn't have to quite go to that pain cave. The other four times he did, it was, you know, the guy ahead was 30 seconds ahead and it was so close that it was every last drop. And I think this applies to through the whole field, basically, that how hard you've pushed comes down to more the mental side of it than the physical side. So if you're really close to that 24-hour golden silver buckle, should be golden, that'd be good, the silver buckle, then you're going to give it everything to get just under. If you're really close to the 30-hour cutoff and you're through the cutoffs all day long, you're giving it everything to make sure that you're not going to get timed out. And if you're around the front of the field and you've got someone within sight, you're giving it everything to catch them, or there's someone right behind you, you're trying to stay ahead of them. And it's that extra level that you don't realize you have until you do it, basically. Like suddenly you think you're giving it everything, and then you spot someone behind you and you speed up 2 minutes a mile because now you've got motivation. And so I thought what he said was really apt to that exact point, which is even though he was sick, he had a great race and it was a tough day, he didn't quite have to give as much as some of the other days. It was maybe his 100% of what he thought he could do, but not above what he thought he could do, which had happened other years. But that happens, like I said, anytime there's a big barrier, like there's a big difference between getting a silver buckle and being 1 minute over a silver buckle, that's when you really dig even deeper. And so those people probably are the ones who push the most, the ones who had just at a margin, had a lot on the line. They probably dug deeper than some of the others. Not that anyone was taking it easy, but I think that it's when it's that fine a margin, that's when you really give it everything.
So I totally agree with Ian. That's such a true point. But I think one of the issues that might apply to some of the racers is it's kind of chaos out there at times, especially when you're in the fog of it. And so I was third place male finisher, Drew Holman was coming in. And he was cramping while going around the track. So he was doing this run, cramp, run, walk. and he looked at me and, you know, we're like really close, like best friends. He looked at me. I'm pretty sure he didn't recognize who I was. He looked straight through me, out through the other side, perhaps all the way to Nevada. and I thought it was really interesting. I was like, wait, why is he doing this? He has like a 25-minute gap on fourth place. And I didn't find out till like a few days later. He thought that fourth place was breathing down his neck the whole time, perhaps because people were not, you know, you're motivated by a lot of things. Like often crews will like, you know, give you some information and not others. And I'm like, I think we should have a rule that in the last 5 miles, there's someone there with like a spreadsheet that lets you know exactly how much you have to give by the time you get to the track, including for the 30-hour finishers, because I think that would prevent some of these track wobbles that we start to see.
Mm. I think that's what I was going to throw at this conversation, because going out the next morning and feeling the heat hit my body again, and I hadn't run 100 miles, those last 2 hours were, what'd we say, 40, whatever, 20, whatever percent of the field came in those last 2 hours with the sun coming up one more time and getting cooked coming across No Hands Bridge and up Roby Point. There's another, I mean, like we're all digging and live, and but that weather element added and the duration of time added for the people that are coming in chasing that 30 hour golden hour mark was really impressive to see. And I got to run in with one of my clients during that time. And I was near tears, like just watching what she was doing. It's pretty cool to have all of those experiences. I got to see Kyle come up and he was all business, like he was chasing down Tim Tolfsen, and that was incredible. Like there was no puke coming out of that guy at that point. It was all guts.
He saves it till after the finish line every time somehow.
Charging. It was awesome.
Chrissy, I'm really inspired by the gutsy second son finishers. And it makes me think, who wants one of those pale silver buckles when you can have one of these brass golden finisher buckles? So I'm starting to rethink which buckle is best.
Right. The stories. You got more stories if you're out there that long, maybe.
If you can remember them.
I was sleeping in my van just above the track, and that I was like, why is John, like John got manager was super, but it was the last right before the 24 hour mark. So that like 4 to 5 a.m. I mean, I don't think the man got a break. He just kept announcing people. So a lot of people squeezed in under that mark. And then I was out running, so I didn't hear it in the last golden hour, but I bet it was pretty similar.
Yeah,
it would be interesting to take watches and clocks off the entire race, and I wonder how the field would finish. You know, the big push that happens for 24 or whatever your number is, that you start timing that and scheduling that and pacing yourself to make sure you get in at that point, and that may start at the river, which is 22 miles out. So it would be interesting just to throw away clocks altogether and let people run their race.
I hadn't thought about that. I also curious how media coverage might influence race dynamics, particularly at the front of the fields. So nowadays, there's videos almost everywhere. Everyone kind of knows where other people are, how they're looking. Ironfar often makes some wonderful observations about how someone's mood appears to be, which is very telling. Like at least this year, it went out so blazing fast in the high country for both men and women. And it was like this everyone was just kind of sucked along by this wind. And I always think like, how much is like knowing the splits at all times in a really specific way and like kind of being in the story as the story is being written? Can that kind of maybe take some people out of their exact race that they're hoping for on that day? Whether you're in the top 10 or just kind of pulled along with it as well, knowing that it's this big event. And I think that's one of the things that makes Western States so fascinating is that, maybe at the beginning it was a bunch of people running from, Olympic Valley to Auburn, but now it's this global experience that everyone is following along on. And I think that brings with it a lot of unique pressures for the racers. And I'm really curious to hear like, how that changes things. I wonder what if we ran 1,000 simulations of this race, would we see like stunningly different results on the day, just given the vagaries of this this big pressure cooker that Western States has become?
I'm going to make a quick question before we move on to the next observation. Coaches, do you think as a whole, as a community, we've lost a little bit because of the year off? Did we lose our ability to go out slow and be disciplined? Did we lose some experience or lessons? And did it show up like we were a little bit cold and had a year off? Any thoughts on that? Ian?
I think there's maybe a little bit of that, but I think it's mainly just a lot of guys wanted to make headlines. Mm. And so they went off hard. They thought, if I can beat Jim and if I can beat Jim's record, then I'm catapulted 10 times higher than coming second. Well, 10 times higher than coming first. Never mind 10 times higher than coming second. Second, people don't even remember. It's crazy. Like my Leadville races, the year I came third, people have no idea I was even there. It's only if you win that they care. It's such a big jump to get to that. So I think there are a lot of men who definitely had it on their radar. They think, well, like Hayden, for example, he beat Jim's record at JFK 50 miler last year. So I'm sure in his mind was, I took Jim down there. I can take him down here. And then I'm making a big splash. So I think there's quite a few guys who are wanting to improve on what they've done before, either because they saw it was a hot year and it's like, okay, there's going to be carnage. I can take advantage of that. Or it's my first time here. I'll make a really big splash if I can win it. And if I can take down the four time in a row, whatever it is, Elk Runner of the Year. So I think that was more on the men's side. The women were a lot more sensible and they were just racing the best for themselves, much more so. And I'm sure that there's a lot of motivation of what position they're in. But as always, I think we tend to get more ego in the men's race and more smart racing on the women's side, just because I'm going to say testosterone, but it's just a male thing. We tend to do that more, but we see it play out every single race.
So that's where I was headed with this, like the observation piece. Like the observation I saw was like running with emotion. There was a lot of emotion that what you described there, David, where the wind took this group. It went out fast. Everybody knows it's going to be hot. Why were they running fast? Like, but you got to give it to the emotion. I mean, I was there to pace Jeff Browning. Jeff Browning, Bronco Billy, 49 years old, known as like this, like he runs smart. He knows how to run ultra 100 miles specifically, like that. He's kind of made a name for himself that way. And he ran on emotion that day. He really wanted to get the Masters record. This was his last chance to go for Mike Morton's 15:45, 41, somewhere in there. And to run a time like that, you kind of got to go out hard. But if it's heat, you got to choose. Like, do you run to get into the top 10 or do you run for a record? I think Jim Walmsley made that choice and it was announced in one of his record or his interviews was that you either run to win or you run for the record. They were two different things on a hot day. So I thought the emotion side, even in somebody that's so well-versed as Jeff Browning, to have the emotions end up taking over, it happens. Like, and that's the specific to a race day observation where we won't do that in training. We can stay smarter, but you put these other media pressure cooker things on it, that ends up adding up. So
that's a great observation by all of you coaches about the emotion piece. So as coaches and as a learning opportunity for all those people that are listening, what would you recommend? How would you advise? How would you coach? Do you take the emotion out of it? Do you try to suppress the emotion and run within yourself and smart, or do you let that emotion kind of give you a kick?
I say you try and rationalize it. So the two people in particular that I had a lot of impact on, especially the person I was pacing, obviously I was talking to him for 8 hours plus the day before and the day before that and phone calls before that. So I was pacing Pat Reagan. He was eighth last time. He's a good friend. I don't coach him, but you know, we have a lot of chats about things and he's going to pace me at my next 100. But I said to him, like, this is a hot year. This is suits you perfectly. You just be a smart runner. He did an insanely fast finish. He actually has the fastest split from the Pointed Rocks aid station at mile 94 something to the finish.
Wow.
Like in the history of the race, last time he ran the fastest anyone ever has. So he closes well. And I said, that's all you have to do in this race. There's going to be carnage. I predicted to him 18:30 would be the top 10 men because of the heat. And it was 18:33. So I'm going to take some credit. That was pretty close. But I told him there's no rush. And so unfortunately, he was feeling bad. So he at least had that in his mind that he didn't have to hammer it early on. But he was feeling bad with the altitude. So he had to hold back. But rather than letting that emotion drive him on and think, oh, I should be in the top 20 at this point, I should be in the top 10 at this point, he just dealt with where he was. So he basically accepted the reality of the day rather than how he wanted it to be. And that's the way that I describe anyone has to do it to race well. And then the other person this was also true for was in second place. Tyler Green, he's coached by one of my other coaches, Matt Lay. I was chatting to him the day before the race and I said, there's going to be a whole load of carnage there. Oh no, Denmark have just scored in the England game.
We're recording this during a very important football match in
the semi-final. Yeah. Anyway, so I thought you guys would want me to have that in the background for added color to this whole thing. But, yeah, so Tyler, I said to him, look, you do not need to push hard. You've got all the experience you need. You've got all the fitness. You did a great race last time. You've gained a lot from doing a lot of FKTs last year. So just be slow and steady and look after yourself and then race people after you've got to Forest Hill. And he did that and he got second place with a breakout race that wasn't really a surprise. But both of these guys, they didn't get drawn into worrying about what their splits were early on. They're outside the top 10. In fact, Pat was outside the top 40 at mile 24, and he finished 11th in the men's field in the end. But it was just about being able to say, well, this is how I feel, and it doesn't matter what anyone else is doing. And that takes a huge amount of confidence and discipline, but it really pays off. And that's where I think the women did that almost unanimously, every single one of them through the top 10. The men, half of the top 10 guys faded back because they didn't do that. And some of the other guys who were top 10 early on ended up dropping out because of not being able to do this. But that's the single thing that I think matters the most, being able to do what you need to be doing based on how you actually feel rather than how you wanted to feel.
You know, that's interesting. I would think as coaches and coaching people that there should be some type of course into some mental management of your race and qualify yourself that way and give instruction on it and quizzes on it and qualify people and certify them to be a smart racer, not only fit racer, but a super smart intellectual racer, and apply that and bring that to the field. Because what Ian was talking about was just supreme knowledge. And if you could apply that, or you could take the women's management of the game and put it in a guy's head and try to get rid of some of the ego and some of the testosterone and apply some mental side to it. We need to be educated mentally to be smart racers. I think that's next.
But this isn't rocket science. We know this. It happens every time. This is why I'm amazed that more people don't manage to do it on race day, because this is pretty obvious stuff we're talking about here. And yet in the moment, people switch off their sensible brain and turn on their, this is the big race brain, and make a mistake.
So you're saying they can actually answer all the questions correctly the day before the race, and then they just blow it out on the race. So you've got certified, quote,
pretty much
certified racers that show up without applying their brain, their skill.
So One thing, though, I think we're slightly overstating the variation in pacing between men and women. The women went out very fast as well. And the times were shockingly fast at the end. Like some of the times that would have won in past years were well down the list. And for some reason, there was less fading going on later in the race. And I think that's a fascinating physiological question as well. But I mean, the women were largely right around course record pace through the high country and even a little bit past that, and, you know, ran some historically fast times in the canyons. And I think there's a lot of things to learn there. And to get to the idea of like how you talk to athletes, I think, you know, Ian is maybe the best, one of the best racers in history at this race. And so he's run it perfectly every year. And I think that needs to be balanced.
If I win it, I can claim that. I haven't won it. Oh,
10 top 10s. I mean, that's legend. Yeah, I mean, I guess Ann Trayson or something is probably the best ever. You're in the pantheon. You're in the Mount Rushmore for sure. But I think that you need to balance that a little bit with like what we were saying before about, well, what if you are winning or going for a record, what is that? Or like a full lifetime breakthrough. And you know, what I was saying to some of my athletes who, you know, maybe on a good day could have competed for the win, scared money don't make money. You gotta put yourself out there. So when Katie Asmuth came through Forest Hill, it was a sight to behold. You know, I think everyone that watched it really learned to love Katie if they hadn't known her on that day. She was coming through just a ball of energy in fourth place at the time. And I said that exact phrase to her because I'm like, all right, you're in fourth place. As Ian said, no one remembers second. Let's see if we can win this thing. And, you know, for Katie, it was hard. Like, I mean, she moved up into second, and I don't think anyone was going to touch Beth on that day, but we didn't know that at the time. And, you know, her quads ended up being pretty darn beat up by the end, but she gave herself that chance. And so I think there's this really hard balancing act of giving yourself the chance, you know, the scared money don't make money mindset with, I need to be smart and race within myself in this pressure cooker. And Ian mastered that. But I think that's so hard as an athlete, because what feels like the right effort, particularly on uphills early on, is totally different than what might actually be the right effort. And often you don't know you're over the line until all of a sudden your quads are totally cooked. And, you know, that's a really complicated factor here. And I think, you know, some of the things Ian and Chrissy have both done personally and with their athletes to develop that are amazing. But for those listening, also don't be afraid to put yourself out there. A DNF in the long term also fine. Sometimes that those are the price to pay for breakthroughs.
That's why I don't want to get rid of the emotion. I think the emotion's a really important part of racing. It's just, what do you do with it? How do you harness it? And I mostly see people waste it in the days leading up to, like doing crazy extra errands, buying the last thing that they think is going to get them to the finish line. Like, we already figured all that out. Let's not waste energy there. So then how do you mentally focus the energy to come out at mile 50 or at Forest Hill or somewhere where it can be more useful than starting off too fast or spending 2 hours walking around the grocery store looking for something that you think is going to help you finish. But I think the emotions are really important and really cool, exciting part. So I love getting to those conversations with clients.
I think that's still a big part of it. I mean, if you want to push yourself at mile 90, you've got to have emotion in there. You've got to care. You've really, really got to care. So I'm not saying that you take that out of it completely, but the subtlety, I'd say, between the women's race and the men's race is seeing the runners come through at mile 24 and 38, where I was crewing. Jim was definitely pushing the pace a little bit, but he's got 4 years of experience of knowing exactly what he's capable of and what the course is like. The guys right behind him looked a bit hurried to me. They looked like they were being pushed 15 seconds a mile too fast, just that small margin. The women were also running fast paces, but much more so, they looked like they were keeping themselves on that edge. They weren't being, I don't think they were reacting as much to the fact that Beth was in the lead. They were just running fast, but just maybe knowing themselves a little bit better than some of the top guys did, I think. So I think that's the thing that you definitely have to take risk to win a big race like this. If you're going to win a UTMB or a Western States or a Comrades, you can't just play it safe. But the first half of those races has to feel relatively comfortable. Whenever I've seen like Killian going through in Hard Rock when he was setting course records, or Jim at Western States, or Rob Krah at Leadville or Western States, these guys are going really fast, but they're looking pretty comfortable. So they're going fast compared to other people, but it's well within themselves. And so I think that's the thing, that sometimes just going an extra few seconds a mile too quick is where you're going to pay for it. And for someone who maybe can think about marathons, maybe you don't have as much experience in ultras, but you've done road marathons. Think about if you go off 15 or 30 seconds a mile ahead of your actual pace you're going to be sustainably doing in the marathon. That's a pretty big difference in pace, and you are definitely going to blow up. And it's the same principle here, that it's just more difficult to know what that is because the pace is jumping around, uphill, downhill, technical, altitude, hot, dark, whatever. While in a marathon, it's much more uniform. And that's where experience really comes into it, of being able to work out, okay, is this my red line or am I just over it? And it's so difficult to judge. It definitely does take some risk.
To add to what Ian's saying there, just as like a little bit of color, totally agree. When Drew Holman came through Forest Hill, I think he was like sixth at the time or something. He's like, we are flying a bit too close to the sun. So I think the hard part is sometimes the racers even know it in the moment. We all do it in our lives. And that's where those really narrow margins can get incredibly complicated. Because on one side is selling yourself short, and none of us want to do that. On the other side is the carnage that we're seeing in Forest Hill and even earlier. And where that line is can be so hard to know. And that's something that comes from like the training topics we talk about and things like that. Like, that's why we're talking about how can you improve just this little thing, this little bit, because that's what ends up being the difference between maybe a breakthrough race and a race that you don't get past mile 62.
I have a question that's related to this that maybe some of our listeners would learn something from. We've talked about starting out too fast. Let's say that we have some people that are listening that don't have a lot of experience at racing. They've been doing the training, and at 5:30 in the morning when you put on your shoes and go out to the trail, you don't have a lot of adrenaline running through your blood, if any. But on race day at 5:30 in the morning, there is a lot of adrenaline. And how do you temper that and prevent yourself from going out too fast and blowing up? What do you do personally, and how do you coach that?
I use one simple phrase, which is, if you think you're going too fast and you're in a 100-miler or 100K, you are. It's that easy. Because if you're even thinking, oh, this is maybe a little bit unsustainable, you're probably well beyond that it even crossed your mind, because you're feeling fresh, you're feeling, you've got the adrenaline and the everything's pumping through your blood and everyone else around you is doing well. So that's a really simple rule. If you're mile five and you think you're going a little bit too quick, slow down, because it's a long way to go. And then you can gain that experience over time. But also you're going to be, your perception is going to be skewed by the fact that everyone else is also pushing a bit too hard and going too fast. So they might be going too hard and you're still going behind them, but you're still above what's sustainable for you. So that's my simple rule of thumb. If you think you're going too fast and it's a long race, then you are.
To give it a little more context, same idea. I'll just use it like a hill as an example. If you're working too hard on this hill and you're trying to envision yourself at mile 80 working at the same intensity, like I would be rather be running the hill at mile 80 than I would at mile 4 leaving or 3 leaving the Olympic Valley. So think, like, if you can walk here to save that energy later, or in my book, there's the spreading the peanut butter analogy. You've only got the energy and you only get to spread it once. Where do you want to leave it? I love cruising in at the end than, you know, what happens in the beginning.
I've got a question for you, coaches. When you're in shape and you're running a race and it's your A race and you're peaked and things are correct, do you let, or how often do you cross over that line? Do you give yourself permission to spend a little bit time over that line, realizing you're over the line and you can step back? Is there any stepping back from the line?
So I think it depends. I think an athlete like Jim Walmsley, maybe there is no line, perhaps. And same goes with Beth Pascal on that day. Like I think that they were playing with the line left and right. I also think that applies a little bit at the front of the field to all the racers, that they have trained to the point that they can exceed aerobic threshold. They can probably even touch lactate threshold sometimes and come back. They have enough peanut butter to go around. But I think for most racers, I love the peanut butter analogy so much. There are certain thresholds, particularly if you're talking about lactate threshold. If you start to get to an effort that you can't sustain for even an hour, even for a short period of time, you're just lighting your peanut butter sandwich on fire. there's not going to be anything left, or exceeding aerobic threshold for a little bit too long on an early uphill. And so, you know, I think one of the ways that, I mean, I've studied the way Ian has raced all the time. I've never told him this, to try to learn how to counsel athletes that might be, I haven't aced that certification test yet, but, you know, one of the things that Ian did really well is he would, I mean, and Ian, please correct me if I'm wrong, is on the uphills, you would really stay within yourself early on in particular, but almost the whole time. And you were confident in your downhill running ability and were able to, you know, your effort was pretty low when you're running downhill, and you were able to balance true sustainability, which for you meant, and for, I think for every athlete, means really being careful on those uphills, particularly early on. And I think, I mean, looking at just even the times to the escarpment this year were really fast all the way up and down the field, not just at the very front. And I think a lot of people were unknowingly lighting their peanut butter sandwich on fire pretty much in the first 15 miles, even if it didn't hit till later on.
Well, it's like Chrissy said, I use that exact same idea, which is if you're on the first climb of the day and you don't think you'd be able to run it as the last climb of the day, then don't run it. Power hike it. And I'm really not a very good uphill runner. So this is quite a low threshold for me. So it's very easy for me to make that decision. For someone who's maybe a stronger uphill runner, it can be harder because they can feel pretty relaxed maybe on an early uphill. But that's a really good context to put on it. But the other thing that can happen is that you allow your effort to creep up when you're going uphill, and then it stays at that higher level afterwards. So you've allowed it to be, let's say, 10 beats per minute higher going uphill. And then because you've now flattened out, you speed up, obviously, but you keep it 10 beats per minute because you've normalized that effort level. And maybe that's the effort level that lasts for 3 hours, but you're going to be out there for 30 hours and it's really going to burn you out quite quickly. So it's very difficult to do that. But a lot of it, again, is discipline and confidence that you're doing the right thing. And I find that confidence is increased over time as long as you keep seeing it pay off. So I've had lots of races where I've been further back than I want to be up the first climb, and then late in the race, I'm passing people and getting where I do want to be. So that reinforces that it was the right thing to do and makes it easier to do next time. I think for someone, if it's their first time doing a new distance and so they don't have that experience, it takes a lot more faith to do that, basically. And that's a really difficult thing to do because you don't know where that red line is. In fact, even when you're super experienced, it's very difficult to tell where that red line of unsustainability is for the length of race you're doing. So there's always going to be a little bit of guesswork, but the less experience you have, the more guesswork there is, the more chance of making a mistake, which is again where I'd say, if in doubt, go a little bit slower for most people as they're learning it. After you've done 1,000 milers, by all means, be taking a bit more risk. You've got a lot of things to compare it to. But the first time you're doing it, much better to be too easy and then you've still got something left in the tank at the end and be moving well than too hard and you're death marching in the second half and people are passing you and you've got the negativity of every single person passing you versus the positivity of catching people. And I saw that with the guy I was pacing, Pat. Every time we caught someone, and this was, you know, every couple of hours we'd catch someone, it's quite spread out. His body language perked right up. His pace sped right up. If anyone had caught him, it would have been the exact opposite. His head would have gone down. It would have been a mental blow. So the better you can feel at the end, the more likely you can actually get closer to what's left in your legs anyway. While if you're feeling demotivated and you've blown up and you're feeling bad that you maybe screwed up the race, it's much harder to even get close to whatever's left in the tank because so much of it becomes mental at that point.
Ian, that is so good. Chrissy.
Just one thought I was thinking of how to help work with it is what thoughts are driving your pace. So I had a conversation with a client who's like, I don't want to be last. Like that's his driver at the beginning of a race. So he takes off so fast, but then he hates it when he's what you were just describing. People are passing him at the end. And I was like, he's like, I want to be those people passing at the end. I was like, well, where did they come from? So like what thought they were last maybe, right? So they that what thoughts are driving your decision to run up a hill fast or what thoughts are driving when you choose to eat and those kind of things might be a way to get at this in terms of how to decide what pace to run early versus later.
There's a great analogy that one of the Western states frequent runners, John Nichols, years ago wrote an article about, he called it rabbit hunting. And he made the analogy that for the first 60 miles, he is the tortoise and he's going to let everybody go out in front of him. And he's just going to just keep his constant manageable effort. But once he hits Forest Hill, which is, we've talked about this many times, that's kind of where the race really starts. That's where he becomes a rabbit hunter and he turns into Elmer Fudd and he starts picking people off. And that's the way that he has run this race for many years. So
tap into your inner Elmer Fudd. I like that.
Hey, let's talk about the heat. You know, in preparation for Western States, we always talk about the heat and how the heat can take you out. This was an extraordinarily hot year, definitely in the top two or three. Were there any lessons that you observed this year that are different from the learnings you've had in the past about how to manage heat? I noticed that Jim Walmsley wasn't wearing his holy shirt again this year. So maybe that was a lesson that he learned. But what did you notice anything or see anything that you put in your notebook?
The thing I noticed that I was like worried for a lot of runners were, especially the top 10, 20 people, was like just drenched, which I totally agree with, but not your feet. And I would just listen to these shoes slopping along the road. And I was like, blisters. Like that was my, they must have been, they seemed to be okay. But just, I know the why of that, but I would always be very protective of my feet. I didn't want my feet to get wet. So I just noticed it, that it wasn't just one or two. It was a lot of people just let themselves be fully drenched. And observation only, I haven't gone much further than that.
And so to jump on to what Chrissy's saying there, totally agree. And like trying to think about how to balance the need to be wet constantly in a race like this with keeping your feet relatively under control, because like, you know, you're supposed to drench in the creeks. Every aid station, they're throwing stuff on you. And I mean, the story that I love the most on that is when Sarah Kies came through Forest Hill, her crew took off her shoes and she was like really jumpy to it. And I looked down underneath her feet and saw something I cannot unsee. And, you know, she was able to get her shoes back on, dry off, you know, powder, things like that. And then went on to an amazing, moved up through the field and finished, I think she ended up finishing 12th. And I have no idea how it was physically possible. I talked a lot of sweet nothings into her ear at that moment about what was going to happen and it was going to go great. But like, I was personally like, I don't know. I mean, that's tough on your feet. And, one of the lessons there that I think applies more generally is the power of giving your body the chance. And that's one of the magical things about these 100s is not to go down these judgment spirals, to have a constant curiosity about what you might be capable of. And I think Sarah embodied that, and the heat probably caused that for a lot of racers going down that point. So yeah, Ian, like actually, I know that you were heavily involved in what Tyler did out there. And I thought he managed the heat so fantastically, throughout. Like, I mean, after the race, for example, when I was talking about that drug testing tent, I saw Tyler, he was the first to go to the bathroom. I saw Tyler after, and I was like, you take a rest day today? I'd be curious about any lessons from that or other things that you saw.
Well, yeah, first of all, I'll just talk about the feet. I think I completely agree there. And at Badwater, which is a completely dry race, no water crossings there, one of the main bits of advice people give you is, yes, stay wet, stay iced up, but do not get your feet wet because you cannot afford to get the blisters there. So you'll see people kind of shouting at their crew going, no, don't get my shorts and the bottom half of me wet, only the top half. And I think that's a fair thing for Western States. So I agree with that where possible, but you still have to run through water occasionally. And then in terms of the heat, one other just thing I notice is I think people have got how to deal with heat now. There's been enough information out there, enough podcasts like this giving people the tips that they need. I thought people dealt with the heat really well overall. Like, the top women and someone like Jim were able to go so fast. The top few men behind Jim as well managed the heat perfectly. And for Pat as well, who I was pacing, he didn't really find it to be an issue. Even though it got to like 100 degrees, it was one of the hotter Western States, it was manageable. Even at that kind of extreme, I think people have now dialed in what it takes. You're using ice at every aid station, keeping yourself wet, pouring liquids on your head between aid stations rather than just drinking everything. I think people have got that message. So I think that's a really big positive there. It still doesn't mean it's easy, but at least people are able to survive through it and in many cases race really well. One thing that Tyler did that I thought was quirky, he mentioned this to me the day before, was Bath Road, which is just before you get to Forest Hill. So you've got 2 miles from when you start hitting the road and you start going through Forest Hill, and the first part of it is uphill, but you can have pacers and crew there. And he had an ice vest, so filled up with ice. It weighs about 5 pounds probably. And he was asking me the day before, do you think I should use it there? Because his crew could give it to him and then take it off him again 10 minutes later. And that's perfectly allowed and reasonable. And I said, you know what? It might be worth at least cooling yourself down for a few minutes with that. And then if it feels like it's a burden or it's melted enough, give it back to your pacer because it's all a crewing area. And I'd never heard anyone do that before, but it was just that attention to detail that he was doing everything he could to manage the heat that really, really paid off. So I think it was mainly just he was being very attentive and he was keeping his pace something sustainable and making sure he got ice at aid stations and wasn't rushing things basically. But that was the one new thing I'd never heard before that I think, especially given how well he did, other people might try and do it next time.
I've got to say, you know, it doesn't surprise me that somehow Ian worked in the weight vest.
Well, no, I was saying to him, we don't want to do weight vest training in the middle of the race. That's totally unnecessary now. So you've got to balance how much you get cooled down while hiking uphill with the fact it weighs 5 pounds. You know, not too much, but if you're hiking, it's probably fine. And if after a couple of minutes it's burdensome, take it off, but at least you've cooled down.
So I think that point is fascinating, and it's something I saw there too, and I was kind of like leading you to it. I think that these cooling rod ice vests that you might wear in aid stations could be a new frontier, especially for people that might stay in aid stations a little longer.
Yeah,
like Forest Hill's a great place because you have crew access that whole time. But for an athlete that might be thinking a 30 or 35 hour 100 at one of these races with longer cutoffs, I think that we're going to see a lot of these products on the market soon. I'm not sure how available they are now, but that's fascinating. Other thing from Tyler that I thought was really interesting, and from other racers, it's kind of common knowledge, but he was covering most of his skin all day long when he was in the sun. He almost, he looked like he was out for a fishing trip or something. And, that's a really interesting choice, and it takes courage because, you're not feeling like you're out there for a 5K, like the feeling of speed, And so maybe that's what we're seeing, is that there is a lot of courage in taking these small decisions that might slow you down slightly at first, not just with pacing, but also with gear choice, and then speed you up a ton later. Because when he came through Forest Hill, even with that little vest on, he was rocking.
And related to that, just the fact Jim Walmsley had a long sleeve shirt on. You know, he was covering up more of his skin as well. But this is what people do in hot countries. This is what people do in the Arab world. They're not like topless walking around in the desert. That's just like our image of, you know, the kind of bearded ultra runner running topless at Western States. It's not the most efficient thing to do. You get a lot of radiated heat direct from the sun onto your skin. You want to cover most of it. That is scientifically and through history what cultures in hot weather have done. So I'm not surprised that that's becoming more normal, but I think it's just for a while there was a kind of an idolized version of the topless bearded guy, even though it's not the best thing to do.
Now, for those that are listening that may not have a map in front of them of Western States, Forest Hill is at mile 62, and it's right before a lot of the canyons.
Right after the canyons.
After the canyons, thank you. And there is a lot of heat there for everybody. It's not a luxury spot for any of the racers on the way through.
I was just going to say, to your point, Chrissy, that you're balancing this idea of keeping yourself wet and having ice on you versus keeping your feet dry. And I'm trying to think, okay, how would I do that? And I like this idea of the ice vest. Maybe we'll see more people using like ice packs, you know, instead of ice itself that melts and gets wet. Although I can see that there's some additional benefit with that ice melting and getting wet, and then there's the evaporative cooling effect there. But maybe using ice packs that don't melt. What do you think, Ian?
Well, it's not so much the ice that's the issue. It's the drenching yourself in water. Like you get to an aid station and they put a sponge on your head or they spray you down. So that's where you're getting the water going lower down in the body. Or if you dunk yourself completely in a river, for example, if it's just ice, that just stays around the head and the shoulders and wherever you put it down the arm sleeve. So that doesn't tend to be as much of an issue there. And I would 100% recommend getting as much ice wherever you can put it. I don't think there's any downside to that.
Chrissy, did you have something?
Oh, my thought was just on the ice packs. Like ice melts and it's gone. Ice pack stays. You've got this gel thing you got to carry along. Yeah. That I've seen them tried, and like people just, you kind of get grossed out by them after a while.
This gives me an idea. I think I've found the perfect solution. It's to have some kind of mini cryo chamber that's probably quite heavy, but with some helium balloons so that it doesn't feel heavy. So you're constantly cooling yourself at all times, but it has no additional weight. I think this is where it'll head towards
like
in the future.
A gerbil running down the trail. Yeah.
I'm sure Nike is already on top of the I'm sure, helium balloon approach.
You've got 1 year to sell it because it's going to become a rule that you can't have it year two. So
that's true. Yeah, it only lasts for 1 year. Yeah,
go strong with your marketing.
What are some other lessons that you learned, or some ahas? You went, oh, that's kind of a neat idea or a cool idea. What else did you learn out there?
I had a fun one in those like the golden hours, working with, coming along and running just with random whoever I saw. And people would be kind of in the death march, and I would encourage them to shuffle. I didn't even say run. I would just say, like, you're on a flat section. It's going to go up again. You can walk there, but try shuffling. And it was just kind of this almost interesting social experiment to see how people responded to that. Like you'd see them like do this kind of hup, hup, and then they'd go a little bit, or somebody'd be like, nope, I'm walking it all the way. Just everybody had different responses to that encouragement. And there was one guy I saw a couple times because I was out and backing a bunch. And every time he saw me, he started shuffling. And I thought, oh, I've encouraged something. So I don't know. Just like you can get in people's heads, I guess, is the observation, is that even when they are kind of maybe easier to get into because all the layers are stripped away, we can still encourage people along and get something a little bit more out of them.
You know, speaking of that encouragement, Leadville made a recent announcement about crews, limited crews and pacing. And of course, we know over in Europe, there's much less crewing and pacing, if any. What do you think about that?
That segues into the point I was going to make about lessons learned. So anyone who had this point where I would answer the question as hiking as the answer, this is you win with this minute in the podcast. But basically power hiking. That is the biggest lesson learned with the 40 miles I was with Pat. The value of having a strong power hike was just underscored yet again that I keep telling him, okay, you're not running that fast right now. Drop into a power hike. It's going to be easier. But when you hike, hike fast. And he would lose no time, but feel much better. And then we'd get back to running a couple of minutes later and run faster. And so that ability to do that, I think, is one of the most important things. And it's very difficult to do because most people use walking as a break. But using power hiking as a strategy, I say it every time. But this, again, showed how important it was. And you can be catching people, even on the flat, if you're power hiking well. Leadville, same kind of thing there, that just a lot of power hiking on the climbs. But it's just very difficult, I think, for people to practice it well enough and to see the value of it. It's not that you have to become the world's fastest power hiker. You just have to become good enough at power hiking that you never do it slowly. That even when your head is out of it, you're feeling dizzy, your stomach's feeling bad, you can still power hike well. And that's where you can gain a lot of time relative to other people. And also it means even your bad patch is still moving well. So regarding the pacing at both Leadville and the fact that people can't pace Hope Pass now, which is the big climb, so they can only pick up the pacer at mile 60 instead of at mile 50, it's going to be the same kind of thing as what I found with Pat, which is it does help to have a pacer there just to keep your confidence up, keep your motivation there, and to tell you little things like, you know what? You don't need to run this right now. Your running is barely a running motion. Drop to a power hike. You're doing that really well. Recover a bit, take on some food, and just to be able to strategize that way. So I think just the fact that a pacer has a clearer head than the runner, they can make those objective choices a lot better for people.
David, do we incorporate enough power hike training in our training plans? And don't answer that because you've seen my pace.
No, I mean, I think it's a great point. I also think it's something that almost every athlete can develop relatively easily as long as they're their fastest version of themselves. And that's kind of what Ian gets into a lot with his, you know.
It doesn't take that long, yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't take that long. So what I like our athletes to do, including the people that might be winning a race like Western States on their good day, is to either use it in a strategic way in training, either in their context of their long runs that might be a little steeper, or uphill treadmill doubles where they'll hop on the treadmill for, you know, it can be 10 minutes, it can be 20 minutes, 30 minutes, and work up to where their biomechanical system and musculoskeletal system is used to that. And usually just kind of at the tail end of training so that it's can become that default where going really fast on power hike is like neuromuscularly not too heavy of a lift. Because I think if you haven't done this, it just feels like, oh my God, I'm kind of just overwhelmed by the motion. And, athletes that do get just slightly used to it and are already their fastest self can usually translate pretty quickly, because the thing with hiking is the output, even at fast hike paces, is low relative to someone's fastest run paces, like the things that they would do in a normal run or let alone in a workout. So the output isn't what we need to adapt to, which is great because those adaptations take a long time. What can go much more quickly is like the neuromuscular biomechanical adaptation. So that's form. That's the last second practice. And by last second, I mean incorporated in the last 6 weeks before your event, if you're going to be doing a ton of hiking, and get confident in it. Like Ian said, it's a security blanket that can always be there for you throughout an event, even when things are really rough. I mean, not when things are like their roughest, but when they're pretty bad, you can always have that hiking. And that's why I think the athletes that do move up through the field are almost always fantastic hikers. Ian himself, you know, foremost among them, of someone that I remember watching him hike once and being like, that's poetry in motion. That's a work of art. But even if we can't be a work of art, we can all incorporate those principles. I just would say it's not something we need to focus on for, you know, year over year over year.
And one thing I'd mention to that is that's the physical side of it and what your body's then capable of doing with power hiking. I think what'll happen with a lot of people is they start doing it, you know, they're 80 miles in, they're a bit tired, and then they let themselves drop off. Like they actually have to concentrate to keep hiking fast, even if their legs are capable of doing it. So there's definitely benefit to practicing that within the build-up races, for example. So if you do a 50 miler in the build-up to 100 miler, and then you're making sure that when you're hiking, you're really keeping your foot on the gas. you're not allowing yourself to have a break, because that is as much mental as it is physical. When you're really tired and you're deep into the race, I keep seeing it with Pat that he'd start power hiking fast and then slow down a little bit. And it's like, nope, keep it up, because you've got to keep the mental effort in there as much as the physical.
We've referred to that as on the podcast before as hiking with purpose. What you can fall into when you start walking during your run is you kind of meander. You're no longer moving with a goal in mind. And then you start beating yourself up like, I'm walking and I'm really not traveling that fast. So now you get some negativity going on. But if you are assertive, you're traveling with purpose and you're efficiently hiking, it becomes part of your plan and you become positive about it. Chrissy.
Just a way to think about it is like, I'll keep my brain engaged by when am I going to run next? Like taking in a landmark that's going to happen. Or when do I get to power hike again? Or like just keeping that changing over. And then a physical aspect to that is like start swinging your arms like you're running before you're actually running to get your body to transition from power hiking to running or the other way. So just some little thoughts to throw into how to keep the brain engaged.
Totally agree. And on the mental side, like walking is trail running. I they're not two different things. So if you're an athlete that walks most of your runs or even all of your runs on trails, you are a trail runner. You are just as valid of a trail runner as Jim Walmsley, who might barely walk a step in the Western States 100. So if you ever struggle with that mindset part of like, oh, does this mean I'm a failure? It's like, no, actually it means the opposite. You are validating your experience as a fully realized trail runner.
I love that.
So great, David, because so many people get so amazed that you walk during these races. So I love that.
You know, Ian, when you were speaking about your pace is really just as efficient as a power hike, what we should do, Scott, on an upcoming run on a hill, I'll continue running and you do a power hike. And let's just see that running and efficient hiking, I bet you we end up pretty close to the same pace. And my output will be much more, because I'm using my same running gait and my same running muscles, and you're giving a little bit of a shift to that and giving yourself a mental break, your muscles a bit of a break, your posture changes a little bit. Let's do that experiment on an upcoming hill. I'll continue running and you shame me with the power hike.
But it's not just about how quick you do that hill. It's how quick you're going after the hill. So it's how good you feel at the top of that hill. That's the really important part. So I've done a lot of tests like this on various hills that I have locally. So there's one that's just over a mile long and it's like a 15% gradient. So it's really on the verge of what I can run anyway. And I've seen how fast I can run every step. That is obviously the quickest, but at the top, I almost need to lie down. Like I'm completely redlined at the top. And so if I were in a race, I would need a couple of miles of going slowly to catch up. If I do a run hike combo, like I do in a race, I was only about a minute slower, but I felt awesome at the top. And if I power hike every step, I only lost another couple of minutes, but again, felt awesome at the top. So it's not like you're giving up huge amounts of time. And if you think of a race like Hard Rock, for example, so one of the highest altitude, hilliest races you can do, people are going to spend more than half their time hiking, because if you say 50% of it's uphill, 50% is downhill, but you go slower uphill. So you're spending most of that race power hiking. It doesn't matter if you're winning it. It doesn't matter if you're Killian. You're still spending most of that race power hiking. So it's a very valid thing to be doing in our sport. And it's a key skill to learn.
David, I appreciate that classification of trail runner. As you were saying that, I thought of a guy that is pretty regular out on the trails here in Auburn. And I finally, after years, I'm embarrassed to say this, guys, and I'm going to say it, and maybe Ryan will edit it out. But Don and I have seen this guy for years, shirtless guy, and he never runs. He has his arms up and he's pumping his arms and he's just power hiking everything, the uphills, the downhills, the flats, everything. And, you know, I think the first time I saw him, I went, wow, that's kind of interesting. And the more that I've grown and matured in trail running, I'm just super excited every time I see him. And just this week, I finally ran into him again and I stopped and I said, I've seen you for years out here. My name's Scott. I want to introduce myself. And he said, hi, I'm Chuck. And that's all he said. And we continued down our way. So Chuck, he doesn't listen to podcasts. I'm sure he doesn't. But I want to give a shout out for Chuck, the power hiker.
I love that. Like, what a great place to like wrap up this podcast too. And that Western States embodies this whole shared experience in the community aspect. So yeah, we talk about performance. We're talking about who wins. We're talking about who even finishes. But what it really means is like everyone getting out there, caring about this one thing, being on the trails at all, or caring about the trails at all, whether we're running or walking or Jim Walmsley or the last finisher or the first DNFer. And that's the beautiful thing about actually going to Western States. So if someone hasn't, I really recommend making a trip out there, going to Forest Hill, going to experience the finish line, not because you want to see who wins, but because you want to see what the human spirit is really capable of and what trail runner actually means and how it can encompass all of these different identities into one like coherent, full, beautiful narrative.
Beautiful. Chrissy?
And just that human spirit, David. The Scott, you asked a question earlier, and I don't know that we totally got to it with the crew and pacers, and we used it into power hiking. But the energy that comes from crew and pacers, and the experience that we get to have, and with other in other countries, that's not as possible as we have here. And I love the energy that comes with people being there to support a runner. And yes, it's a very solo mission, but there's a huge team aspect that comes out of having that gathering that we got to feel on the Auburn track, like all the different crews that were there cheering on the runners that you get to come witness. And, you know, the job doesn't stop when the runner crosses the finish line. I saw runners being carried by crew and maybe even helped to the showers or whatever. And there's a lot that goes into the human spirit. I like that language around it.
And Chrissy, to close, trail running is more than the training run, more than the race. It's exactly what you three were doing on that weekend. It was out there participating as a trail runner, as a pacer, a crewer, aid station worker, all of those as a coach, all of those make us trail runners. And we can all learn, even if we're not on the trail running, by observing. And that's what we hope we got out of this podcast today. Coaches, thanks for coming on and sharing your knowledge and sharing your learnings. It was great to see you guys out there. And you guys are full of energy and positivity, and we absolutely love it.
You know, here on Trail Runner Nation, we get a great chance to sit down for an hour with coaches, but you may need your own hour. Ian, how do you get a hold of some of your coaches, Chrissy being one of them, and David?
Very easy. All you have to do is just, my social media is all at Charmin Ian, at Charmanian or CharminUltra.com.
Fantastic. Well, do you have room in your stable for new athletes?
I do. At the moment, only one of the coaches, Hillary Allen, has any openings. But yes, we always have at least kind of one or two people we can take on at any point.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Chrissy?
My coaching page is on my website. If you can spell my last name, you'll find me. Chrissymoehl. Same on all the Instagram. I'm not much of a Twitter person. And what was the other question? Oh, I am not taking anybody until August 1st because I am currently on the road and I don't like to start new clients when I am traveling. But maybe by the time this podcast comes out, we will be past August 1st.
Good.
And David?
Some Work All Play. Listen to the Some Work All Play podcast if you don't.
Yes.
My wife, Megan, and I. Yeah, we love you all. Thank you. You can just Google me. I'm everywhere and nowhere. I'm like Batman.
You're like the wind.
Exactly.
That, you should have that as your tagline. Some Work All Play. I'm like
that. Just bat people over here. Just Megan and I.
Hey, we can't thank you enough for your friendship and for your time and your wisdom. You guys are awesome. We just really enjoyed these conversations. So thank you. So go out and run.
Mas.
We want to thank Doug Crumley at Ameriprise Financial Services for being a business Patreon supporter. What are your passions? What do you want to pursue next in life? Do you want to be a mentor or a coach, a volunteer at a trail running event, travel overseas to your running dream ultra? your Ameriprise private wealth advisor, Doug Crumley and Crumley & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, LLC, can help you plan for that next life you want today and well into the future. With the right financial advisor, life can be brilliant. Visit www.DougCrumleyJr.com. That's DougCrumleyJr.com. It's the end of the show, and we would be amiss if we didn't thank a few people. First of all, the listener. Thank you for making it to the end of the podcast. We knew it was probably harder than running 50 miles, but we're grateful to you. We're grateful to our Patreon supporters. We need to talk about the Cocopelli 1000, which is coming up. Those Patreon supporters have bibs. They're waiting to learn more about that. If you want to become a Patreon supporter, go to trailrunnernation.com and click on the support us at the top of the screen.
We need to thank our producer, Doug Mayer, who helps put this thing together and gives us some direction. And importantly, sound man Ryan, who really makes sure that, well, we sound like we're doing our job, Scott. Without him, it would be chaotic.
Tune in next week for another episode. Thank you.